again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, talking to you today from our cloud covered Vancouver. Surprise, surprise. But I am going to enjoy the brightness that comes from having a conversation with a fellow Canadian. Zach Felschenfeld is first author on a paper that will be released in the December 2018 issue of Medical Education, entitled Stethoscope of the 21st Century, Dominant Discourses of Ultrasound in Medical Education. Zach is an assistant professor, as of this past April, in the Division of General Internal Medicine at University of Toronto, and more specifically at the Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center, where he works clinically. Zach, first of all, congratulations on your appointment to the faculty, and also, I guess, on the completion of your master's that I understand this work was a part of.
Yes, thanks very much.
Yeah, it's a busy and exciting time in your life, no doubt. So impressive that you were able to pull off such a large project. And before we get into the details of what you actually did, I'm sure many of our listeners will be familiar with the increasing discussion and focus around point-of-care ultrasound. It seems like an engine that's moving fairly strongly down the track. And I want to start by asking why you thought it important to take a pause and offer some reflection on how this discussion was developing.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak about this paper. As you mentioned, my master's thesis project was a part of the research project that has culminated now in this paper. The initial germ of the idea to examine point-of-care ultrasound in medical education came about 5 years ago now. I was having a discussion with one of my mentors and co-authors on this paper, Dr. Ayelet Cooper, about a thing that I had noticed when I was first interviewing for residency positions in internal medicine a couple of years previously across Canada. And it seemed almost overnight, all of the various internal medicine residency programs were inventing and innovating and truly excited about their new point-of-care ultrasound curricula. In Canada, when you apply for residency programs at the end of your 4 years of undergraduate medical training, you interview for various jobs at different universities across the country, and part of that involves going to visit those programs and hearing about the programs and the things that they offer for your training. And it really was surprising how often a point-of-care ultrasound curriculum was held up as a centerpiece of the training. And it was interesting because being near the end of my medical training in Toronto at that time, I hadn't really seen a point-of-care ultrasound machine be used in the internal medicine rotations that I completed. And so it kind of struck me that everything all of a sudden had just bloomed across the country, this enthusiasm for ultrasound education. I started my residency in Toronto, and so too in Toronto overnight we had point-of-care ultrasound for our bedside procedures. And so my first thought was there must have been some obvious evidence for this. There must have been some landmark trial or series of papers or something to lead to what seemed like quite a big change. And in my first couple years of training, I read around it a little bit and hadn't really come across an obvious paper. And so when I was discussing this idea, this question that I had, where did all of this come from? Why all of a sudden? Why everywhere at once? Dr. Cooper decided to ask me a few questions and asked me if I knew why we did anything in medical education, why we were trained in any way. And that really was the start of the process for me of getting interested in medical education research. I began thinking about some of those really challenging why questions. When I began my master's in medical education at Maastricht, I decided to pursue this question of why and where from came these medical education curricula, and decided to learn about a fairly complicated methodology that we used in this paper that's known as critical discourse analysis. And I want to say the rest is history, but the rest is really 5 years of quite a lot of work, and it's been quite an interesting experience for me. I've learned quite a lot from a methodological perspective, but also I've really spent a lot of time steeped in this relatively narrow field of research, and it was quite fascinating to gain the insights that I've written about in this paper.
we won't be able to go into great detail around the methodological approach given time limitations, but you mentioned that you used a critical discourse analysis, and I wonder if you can flag up what is the core feature of that? What was the reason you thought that it was an effective technique for the purpose you tried to fulfill?
That's a very good question. There are different methodologies that can fall under the umbrella discourse analysis. The specific one that we were applying is known as Foucauldian critical discourse analysis. It's not an easy methodology to talk about per se, especially as a non-expert, which I consider myself to be. The idea behind doing a Foucauldian critical discourse analysis is really to understand by looking at language, by looking at text, by looking at discourse, and discourse has a very technical definition, Foucauldian critical discourse analysis, to understand a little bit more about why practices are the way they are. From most constructivist research paradigms, we feel that social practices are constructed. Foucauldian critical discourse analysis really enables, as I put in the paper, researchers to study constructs that might otherwise be considered natural, to really take a step back and step outside of the discourse, the way that things are talked about, and be able to, the term that we sometimes use is make strange. Look at how, if you weren't deeply embedded within this discourse or within this way of thinking about this topic, how this has come to be in the way that it's come to be, to kind of not take for granted assumptions about a particular topic or idea or concept. I'm sure that I'm not doing justice to a good way to describe Foucauldian critical discourse analysis, and I'm also sure that my supervisors might be cringing hearing this description, but I promise I put it more succinctly in the paper.
No, that's very well said. My understanding from your paper and from other places is that part of the goal is to not necessarily prove one discourse right or wrong, but rather to try to highlight, as you said, the variety of ways in which people are talking about these things, in part to understand what the advantage or purpose of talking about them in those ways might be. So with that in mind, there seem to be three discourses that you identified in the literature, and I'm recognizing that we can't go into all the details. If you can share your thoughts around why it appears that there are a variety of discourses present and whether or not it gave you particular insights into this evolution that you described you discovered on heading into residency.
Right. So, you know, a lot of the research done using Foucauldian critical discourse analysis, the upshot of a lot of this type of work is to identify dominant discourses, or what are the primary ways that ideas or concepts are constructed. And sometimes you come up with a few different ones. They really do, in most cases, intersect and overlap, and the number is not as important as just trying to characterize the ways in which these ideas and concepts have been talked about from a dominant perspective, or what are the dominant discourses, and what are the implications of that, as you had said. So in our work, we identified three dominant discourses, three leading ways that ultrasound in medical education is represented. The names are names that we picked to help try to crystallize these discourses. The first one that I write about in the paper is the visuocentric discourse. And in this discourse, ultrasound is held as a truth instrument. So it's identified as making truth or making knowledge about the patient knowable and accessible by turning sound waves into visual data. And that visual instrument, the way to access the patient's inside using visual data, not unlike most of our other imaging techniques, is held up as superior to other sources of data. The implications there largely rest on the fact that other sources of clinical information, sources of clinical data, become devalued. Other ways of knowing, other ways of learning become less important or devalued via this discourse. The second discourse we term the utilitarian discourse. In this discourse, really, some of the representative statements point to the belief that ultrasound will improve patient care, will improve health of our patients, and so we must be training our medical trainees to use point-of-care ultrasound in order to achieve this goal, in order to provide 21st century care and make our patients better and safer and provide better care. It rests on quite a number of truth statements or assumptions that are relatively undersupported or underfounded. Statements about the utility, really, of point-of-care ultrasound, especially as a diagnostic tool. In the third discourse that we identified, which we termed the modernist discourse, the ultrasound is presented as a futuristic descendant to the stethoscope, which ubiquitously hangs around most clinicians' necks, should be replaced by a more modern, technologically advanced ultrasound machine. And this has implications, obviously, for the training of medical students and residents, implications that come to fruition in the publication of education guidelines, curricular guidelines, and surveys that are published in the literature, at least, of adherence to those guidelines, and truly may lead to a change in the roles and identities of clinicians and of non-clinician specialist healthcare providers like ultrasound technicians, radiologists. And again, there's a lot more in the paper looking at how we identify these discourses as well as the discursive effects or sort of more commonly implications of identifying these discourses.
And all three are very pro-ultrasound, and I suppose that makes sense given that if it was an innovation that people were very negative about, then it likely wouldn't gain the momentum that led you down this path in the first place. But what are a couple of the implications that you think to arise from the fact that people are talking about this in different ways? And I guess in particular, I'm wondering if you can unpack a little bit for us why you felt compelled after doing this work to label ultrasound the stethoscope of the 21st century. Does that imply something that might not be immediately obvious to those who haven't read the paper?
So the term stethoscope of the 21st century is a phrase that's repeated throughout the archive, the large number of texts that we examined. And what I found interesting getting steeped in this literature is that the very first reference of ultrasound to a stethoscope, or calling it the new stethoscope or the stethoscope of the future, was quite critical of ultrasound. The author, writing in the late 1980s, compared ultrasound to the stethoscope, and I quote, said, "used by many, understood by few," highlighting a concern that with increasing ubiquity of handheld ultrasounds or point-of-care ultrasounds, at the time they weren't quite small enough to be handheld and not transportable, there would be increasing potential misuse that went hand-in-hand with increasing use. That coreness to the identity of a physician that the stethoscope has become over the past two centuries, likening the point-of-care ultrasound to the stethoscope, really seeks to make that connection explicit for enthusiasts and proponents. They really are not just in favor of ultrasound, but are of the view that ultrasound should and would improve patient care and medical education by replacing the stethoscope and getting in that place. We use it in the title of our paper because it really might be the stethoscope of the 21st century. And though we're critical, as we allude to a number of times, the goal of this work is not to completely delegitimize the place of point-of-care ultrasound in clinical medicine or in medical education, but really to be critical for the sake of moving the discussion forward. If I have one concern, my biggest concern throughout the literature that I reviewed or that I looked at for this paper was that there is very little critical work published about point-of-care ultrasound. And I agree with your statement that if there was a lot of negative discourses, things wouldn't have moved forward. But the lack of critical voices, the lack of questioning voices, can lead to some unexamined assumptions. Towards the end of the paper, we included a table of some sample questions as we were thinking about ways in which identifying these discourses, critiquing and analyzing these discourses could open up future avenues of research, future avenues of inquiry to better understand what this process of involving point-of-care ultrasound and medical training could lead to. Some of the questions that we raised when we frame the role of a doctor, the identity of the doctor as a very technical and technological role. The doctor is the wielder of the point-of-care ultrasound machine, is the accessor of the visual data inside the patient. Will we be training clinicians, or will we just be training point-of-care ultrasound technicians who have a little bit more clinical knowledge? When we rely on visual data from point-of-care ultrasound or really any of our diagnostic tests in modern medicine. And if we believe this to represent truth or incontrovertible truth, what are the clinical dangers of seeking truth in that way? Are there dangers to the patient's clinical care? Are there dangers to the patient-physician interaction and diminishing perhaps parts of their experience and interpretation of their symptoms, their clinical narrative history? And, you know, a big one that's really not discussed widely in the literature, what are the costs if every medical school needs to have a point-of-care ultrasound machine for every medical student, or at least enough for the medical students to learn adequately on, if all the residency programs need to have these, if every doctor leaving training is going to need to purchase one or have enough around in their facility for all of these machines to be purchased and maintained, what are the costs of that? Is that cost warranted? I don't think the answers to these questions will all be negative. I don't mean to paint a doom and gloom picture that the point of care ultrasound revolution is ruining medicine. What we want to highlight is that these are questions that are not being asked, and that the asking of these questions could potentially lead to very interesting answers that as yet are unexamined.
And it doesn't seem to me as though you're painting a doom and gloom picture, but these are absolutely crucial questions. And so I'll just end by thanking you for raising them. You used the phrase critical voice, and this paper clearly provides that and offers a really nice pause, I think, in the way this is evolving, not to stop it, but rather just to make sure that things are continuing to move in a productive and sensible direction. Just as a way of wrapping up, I'll remind anybody listening that what we have been talking about is a paper entitled Stethoscope of the 21st Century, Dominant Discourses of Ultrasound in Medical Education. The voice you've been hearing out of the mind is Zach Felschenfeld, who's first author on the work that will be released in the December 2018 issue. So impressive work, in particular as a component of a master's project, as you said, or at least emanating out of your master's project. And so I'll congratulate you and thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us about it.
Thanks again for the opportunity to talk about the paper.